expanding on all of the top sports headlines. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
I got a picture of a photograph of a wedding in a shell. It's just a burning image.
Well, you know, Stephen, we're used to celebrating LeBron James and generally NBA players in general for their political awareness. I mean, if you're of a certain political bent, you sort of almost see them social allies in a lot of ways. But, wow, my goodness, LeBron James and a lot of smart people are really getting themselves twisted into knots dealing with this fallout from Daryl Morey's tweet in support of Hong Kong.
Yeah, I guess LeBron felt compelled to say something. I guess people expect him to say something. And what he said is crystal clear, you know. And the people who are going to be most disappointed in what he said are the people who see him, as you suggested, as a guy who, you know, and see the league as a league where people speak freely and have opinions and are willing to upset the challenge power and all of that stuff. Because, you know, again, with this, there's been a lot of kind of a lot of smoke blown around this situation, trying to make it seem like something that it's not. Say, well, you know, this is very complex, and you have to take into account history and culture and sensitivities and the post-colonial history of China and what that means, and the idea of how Chinese nationalism, you know, and how people feel in China about Hong Kong and Taiwan and Tibet and Macau and et cetera, et cetera. I think everybody should probably bone up on that stuff. It is interesting. Now, I'm not sure, you know, and then we can make our own decision about how people treat protesters,
right?
And who are essentially suggesting that the deal that they cut, that the deal that was cut when Hong Kong was handed back to China by the British, that, you know, that they're changing the terms of that in a way that is going to restrict their rights. Everybody ought to get down and study that. It is interesting and complex, and it's a different history than, there are different ways to view that history.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's a different way to view the protests or the value of free speech, but that's up to you. But the point is, what this is about is money. And what LeBron James said essentially was that the tweet that Daryl Morey should have known what that tweet would do. Well, what that tweet could possibly do is cost people money, cost the NBA money, cost the NBA players money, to the point where, you know, there's actually stuff been written suggesting that, you know, if China, you know, follows through and restricts that market for the NBA, that it could actually go as far as affecting the salary cap in terms of, because of the massive impact it could have on the NBA's revenues. That's the impact he's talking about. He's not talking about Chinese history or culture. He's not, you know, there's not even a thoughts and prayers for the protesters. There's not,
no.
There's not even lip service being
there
paid.
There isn't at all.
No, and it's not. And so I don't know if Michael Jordan actually ever said that Republicans buy sneakers too. It was, you know, but he thought it.
Yeah. And he's right.
Well, by that token, you can do business with anybody over anything. And that's the only thing that matters. How far do you want to go with that?
Well, I would say we'll play the James tweet in a minute, but I'll say this, Stephen. I mean, one of the reasons that there's so much smoke around this is so many companies, some of them very close at home. I mean, they do business with China. They do business with the Chinese government by extension, state-owned companies. That, to me, is the biggest reason is you can't come out and do a complete and total hammer job on it because you don't know. You just don't know where your company's alignment is. It's a sign of Chinese economics.
I know you can still take a stand on free speech. You know, that's not, unless, you know, the only thing that matters is the market. If that's the only thing that matters, you're right. If it's only about money, you know, and if it's about what people claim, you know, as their own territory, well, you know, history would suggest you could have just said, hey, yeah, take it, go ahead, it's all yours. That, you know, that history would have been different. If we'd allowed that at different times in history. So, yeah, if the only thing that matters is money, you're right. And apparently the only thing that matters is money. That's what this is all about.
It is, absolutely. This is LeBron James yesterday in a scrum before an exhibition game that he did not play in. And he was asked about Daryl Morey's comments. And bear in mind that LeBron and the Lakers were overseas, and because of a blackout on media availability, this was actually the first chance for anybody to be able to get any comments from LeBron. Effectively, I can't say this any other way. LeBron had about 6 days to figure out what the hell he was going to say in regard to this.
Yeah, and he could have said, and he also could have said nothing.
He could have said nothing. This was LeBron James last night. Derek.
We all talk about this freedom of speech. Yes, we all do have freedom of speech. But at times, there are ramifications for the negative that can happen when you're not thinking about others and you're only thinking about yourself. So I don't believe, I don't want to get into a word or sentence feud with Daryl. Morey, but I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand, and he spoke, and so many people could have been harmed, not only financially but physically, emotionally, spiritually. So just be careful what we tweet and we say, and what we do. Even though yes, we do have freedom of speech, but there can be a lot of negative that comes with that too.
And I'm going to say this, Daryl Morey, in fact, is fairly well educated on this. He has friends in Hong Kong. Like Daryl Morey didn't roll out of bed and say, you know what, I think I'm going to send a tweet in Hong Kong today.
But you know, it doesn't matter. Like,
no, but I'm saying, LeBron's making it sound as if he was this rube that just got up one morning and tweeted and, I shouldn't have done it.
I don't even, like, again, if Daryl Morey is a complete ignoramus, it doesn't matter. The issue here is, the notion that Daryl Morey did this, that it was somehow in his self-interest to make that tweet, that it was selfish for him to have done that. It would seem, I'm trying to frame that as a selfish tweet that would help Daryl Morey.
Kind of hard to
wrap your head around that, even if it had just, kind of gone off into the Twitterverse and no one had ever paid any attention to
it. Some might call it a career killer.
Well, I'm sure he didn't think so, but I'm sure, it's pretty innocuous to stand up, say free speech is good, right? Like that's a reasonably innocuous sentiment in our culture.
Used to be.
The notion that, he somehow did it selfishly and then the implications, you'll notice which one came first on that list. Financial. Because that's the only one. I don't think anybody was in danger here. I'm sure it was a little uncomfortable for the players that were in China. And they didn't probably want to answer those questions.
I'm sure they had good security, though. They tend to.
But I don't think anybody was physically endangered by that tweet. And all of the other stuff that came after that. Financially, though, yeah, he's got a point.
He's absolutely got a point.
That's the only point.
And we got to, absolutely, and we have to keep this in mind, as Matt Devlin told us, relaying a conversation he had with Shaquille O'Neal. Shaquille O'Neal basically lived off his sneaker revenue. He pocketed his salary, or his salary was put towards investments. And it's not just, and you're right, it could have a profound impact on the salary cap and all that stuff and league revenue, but there's also a matter of individual marketing and individual branding.
So he's not even thinking about the collective good, he's thinking about his individual good.
Steven, I would think that the individual good's at least part of it.
Oh, yeah. Look, I think it probably was. I think he's probably thinking about a whole bunch of things, but all of those things would be in one category.
Yes.
Which is
financial.
If they get mad at us, they won't let us into their market, and we won't be able to get money. It's not about the rightness or wrongness of the issue at hand. It's not a debate about, anything to do with, the fact that people in Hong Kong are going to be thrown into the Chinese legal system if they're accused of a crime, rather than being dealt with in a separate legal system that has a different set of values. That's no one's talking about that, because that's not what anybody's interested in here.
Now, there's a couple of sort of side stories to this and that also involve LeBron James. And one I think is particularly interesting. Paolo Uggetti of the Ringer, citing an ESPN report on a meeting that LeBron James had with the commissioner, LeBron James and some players had, the commissioner in China. One of the players, and I don't believe it was LeBron necessarily, asked Adam Silver, well, if a player had sent out a tweet, or made a comment that cost the NBA millions of dollars, there would be repercussions in terms of a fine or a suspension. Why aren't there any repercussions now for Daryl Morey? Two things. One, we don't know for sure. There haven't been or won't be repercussions. But it's interesting how this has now kind of, in some ways, become a bit of a CBA issue,
I suppose. But again, if it's only about costing the NBA business, if that's the bar here, right? So if somebody tweets something that costs us money, they should be punished for it, right? If that's the only bottom line here, then okay. But, you know, you're going to have to suppress a whole bunch of stuff then. You know, this is a big one because you've got a lot at stake in that market. And the way to succeed in that market is to keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
But if that's all that matters, he's right. He's absolutely right. If that's the only value that's at play here, and it clearly is. So, right. Yeah. You know, I just don't pretend it's anything else.
No,
there's nothing else going on here.
No.
And I say Daryl Morey, you know, his tweet at face value is innocuous and is something that the vast, vast, vast majority of people would support in its kind of innocuous, non-specific way. We think people should have the right to free speech and the right to protest, right? And we do. That's kind of fundamental to our values. Maybe we, you know, and whether we stick our noses into what people are doing in other places, we do that all the time. Here's the question, and this is, you know, this is, and if Tiananmen Square happened right now, how would those people react to it?
I don't know. I think I know now.
Yeah. Well, there okay. You go.
And. Well, there's so many ways we go with this, but let me bring up the whole issue of, I'm going to call it false equivalency. I don't know if it's necessarily, but let's,
oh, there's lots of false equivalency okay. here, but yeah.
But let's just kind of break off from that for a minute. You know, one of the points that of course has been made about the NBA's reaction is, okay, you guys are more than ready to hammer Donald Trump or more than ready to handle or hammer a police department when something happens. You're more than ready to speak out on civil rights in the United States, yet when it comes to a situation where there is a real, I could say, a pronounced economic impact, now all of a sudden you're scared to speak up. So let me ask you this, Stephen. The next time something happens in the U.S., and bear in mind we're getting close to electoral season there, is somebody going to put the clamps on NBA players when it comes to making comments about
I doubt it.
U.S.
There's no skin off their nose, though.
But again, people are going to draw that comparison. You guys were scared to talk about things in China. It is a false equivalency, but you're scared to talk about things in China. Therefore, you should not talk about things that happen at home.
I didn't see any sign of the NBA clamping down on players talking about all kinds of things, in American society, mm-hmm. because you would say that's a good thing because yes. those are things that should be talked about. And especially in issues of race, you know, a league with so many prominent African-American athletes, it's great that people are taking a stand and saying things. And that's all true still. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that, and you cannot argue with this, that is that there was no skin off their nose there. Right. Like, you know, that you might lose your racist fan base, but you know, that's about it. Right.
The point is still going to be made by people.
Well, like, it's legit to say, It is legitimate to say the limits of, you know, there are limits to mm-hmm. what you guys are willing to speak freely about and comment freely. And the limits appear to be financial. Like, that's legit. It's black and white. Like, I wish there was some other conclusion to draw here, but I can't come up with one.
Do you have a problem with that?
I think if your only values are the marketplace and financial, then I think it leads, you know, I would say that leads the world into bad places. I think there's a lot of evidence of that. If that's the only thing that matters,
has LeBron James been diminished as a symbol? Has he been diminished because of this?
He's Michael Jordan, right? He's a businessman. That's what he looks like, a guy who's doing business, and he's worried about his business being affected.
But we always kind of put him on a different,
I don't know,
a different level.
Maybe,
before.
Yeah. You reveal yourself to be what you are, you know. And in this case, he revealed himself to be that. It's about, you know, again, the self-interest here is not Daryl Morey's self-interest, because, again, I can't connect dots to make this in his self-interest. I just can't see how that was about him. It wasn't even about him putting himself on a, you know, on a platform. It was so meaningless in that sense, right? He wasn't attracting attention to himself, and it wasn't what he was saying was, again, is something that on the face of it, virtually everyone would agree with. But you know, the flip side of that is that the opposition to him can only be that opinion, the opinion that it was selfish and that he didn't understand who he was hurting. The only way he hurt people was financially. That's it. That's the only way that this hurts LeBron James or the NBA or anybody else is money.
And the Chinese would say the Chinese would tell you that it was deeply hurtful to them, Daryl Morey's comment. Chinese public opinion in the mainland, well, again, at least what we know. I mean, there's a lot of people in mainland China that support the heavy-handed, heavy-handed nature of what the police are doing.
Yeah, but probably they're not, you know, the Uyghurs in there in concentration camps or the Tibetan people or
absolutely,
you know, like this. Like, so no, we have the right. I think free speech and you know, you can comment on this. It's legit. I'm sure that there are people in China who for whom their sovereignty over Hong Kong is fundamental to their, you know, their sense of nationalism. I get that. You know, they feel the same way about Taiwan. You know, that would be that'll be an interesting moment down the road.
Oh yes,
but that doesn't. But that's got nothing to do. This isn't about hurting. This isn't about the cultural sensitivities or the history of China. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with selling stuff to people in China. That's all it has to do with. It couldn't be more clear. So you know, we can go around in circles, and I think. You know, I think people have tried to kind of, you know, kind of find a way to say, well, this is, you know, if you actually understand the culture and the history, this is not what the culture and the history, as I said, is complex. And in some ways, some of it is foreign to us because we have a different history that we were brought up on, especially a place like Hong Kong. We have a very different take on the history because of this, where we come from. And we were part of the British Empire. But this, I just muddy in the waters. Like no one's having a debate about history. No one's even really having a debate here about, you know, about the issue in Hong Kong. There's no one's debating that. No. They're debating the fact that the only, it's not even a debating point. They're scared that they upset some people.
And they're going to lose money.
Like I'd stand up and if anybody would like to have, you know, and again, if you weigh in on Chinese internal affairs, if that's what we decide this is, then I guess you do so at your own peril. But clearly you do so at your own peril, but just don't, there's no other value system at play here. There's nothing else at play here. It's just they're cowering, you know, and, you know, I guess you say, well, they've millions of dollars. I'd cower too, I guess.
Is there anything the NBA, Stephen, should have foreseen about this going over to China? I understand that this isn't the type of tour you put together in a week. So I presume this was probably planned before incidents in Hong Kong, before it got to the point where it got. We're used to seeing Adam Silver, you know, yes, he works for the owners. We get all that. Every commissioner works for the owners. But Adam Silver generally, very seldom does he put a wrong foot forward. He's usually pretty adept at striking the right tone. Were they just not prepared for this? Should somebody have seen this coming?
Well, except that what are you going to do? Tell everybody in the league don't have an opinion on anything?
Have a message. I mean, if it does happen, it's not just LeBron James. Like, it took Adam Silver 2 days to finally hit the right tone. So it's not just LeBron making a comment and then LeBron falling.
And again, he was kind of trying to have it both ways, which I'm not sure that you actually can. But yeah, he was dancing on both sides of this because it did blow up in a way that I don't think they and but look it, again, there are two Canadian nationals are in jail in China right now because of the arrest of the Huawei executive and the potential extradition of her to the United States. You know, China doesn't mess around. They do things in a certain way, and if you do business with them. You do it on their terms. And if you do business in that country, you definitely do it on their terms. You know, again, we take for granted. And again, like we're in murky territory now with Lord knows with all of the stuff that's happened on various social media platforms here and kind of where truth and responsibility lie. But, you know, if you wade into China as a search engine or something, you know that you're going to be restricted. You know that you're not, that people there don't have access to everything that you have available, that the government's going to restrict the flow of information. And I guess you would decide that that's worth it. You do business on their terms. And so I guess what surprised, you know, Adam Silver was that, you know, just how absolute that was, that one tweet by one general manager about a situation that's on the national news, you know, that it's not like people didn't know the protests were happening in Hong Kong. There's been coverage of it in the news media. But if you're a partner with these guys on some level, you know, if you're in a business transaction, you can't do it. So I'm guessing that surprised them.
Coming up, I think you can make the case that tonight's Canada-U.S. men's soccer match at BMO is the most eagerly anticipated in some time. I mean, Canada's in the mix for a CONCACAF World Cup berth. It's the first time John Herdman has coached the men's team against their bitter rivals. And in terms of talent, I think we can safely say that this is one of the most talented Canadian teams we've seen in some time. It's Canada and the U.S. at BMO tonight. Grant Wall of SI joins us to break it down. This is Writer's Block with Blair and Brunt on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder, we'll have the Minnesota Wild and the Toronto Maple Leafs on Sportsnet 590 The Fan at 7 o'clock tonight. Tons of baseball getting underway in just a little more than an hour from now. The Astros and Yankees at 4 p.m. on Sportsnet. Giancarlo Stanton is not in the lineup for the Yankees. Aaron Hicks is in batting ninth. Cards and Nats at 8 o'clock on Sportsnet. The Nationals can advance to the World Series. Jim Duquette, baseball analyst with MLB Network, joins Brunt and myself in the top of the next hour to talk about that. But as we mentioned before the break, the Canadian men's soccer team takes on the U.S. tonight at BMO Field. Stephen Brunt, 34 years, 17 matches since Canada's beaten the U.S.
Mm-hmm. There was a time back in the midst of history when the two were kind of equivalent in terms of where they stood in the football world. Canada and the U.S. were kind of, they were both kind of, you know, not in the main conversation. But that feels like a million, well, it is a million years ago now. It is, but this is, look, we had John Herdman in here the other day. I want to believe.
Yes.
I love John Herdman. He's great. And if you sat here with him for 15 minutes, you would believe that all things are possible. But this is an interesting test with a different kind of Canadian side, you know, really exciting young Canadian side. Also, interested to see, going to sit in the stands tonight with my son. You know, home support for Canada has always been kind of an issue, you know, just, you know, we don't turn out the same way necessarily.
Place is apparently not going to be sold out.
Which is really unfortunate.
Yes.
It should be. I'm not telling people what they should care about, but people are going to have to, you know, people are going to want some proof, right?
Yep.
They want encouragement.
Yeah, I think that's what one of the points John made when he was on with us last week was that he understood that, you know, again, 34 years, 17 matches. There's been a lot of talk about we got to do it now. This is our best chance. And the Canadian men have not come through. John Herdman promising blood, guts, and thunder today. Let's bring in Grant Wall.
Right.
Let's bring in Grant Wall. That's
the
of SI.
The Jordy in him comes out every once in a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. How you doing, Mr. Wall?
I love John Herdman.
Yeah, we all love John Herdman, man.
Blood, guts, and thunder. I wonder if his players got the message about that.
He's a fascinating story, though, just to go from the Canadian women's team to the men's team. And he's never been afraid to speak his mind, and he seems to be a pretty good motivator of players.
Yeah, it'll be fun tonight for sure. This is probably their best. This is their best chance because, it's the most offensively talented team Canada's had probably in my lifetime in terms of pure offensive talent.
I'd say
there's
so.
Some shaky issues defensively. But, it feels like this is probably the best chance they've had in a while to beat the Americans. Grant, I wanted to ask you, tell us a little bit about where the American program is now.
It's still very much dealing with this horrible failure of failing to qualify for the last World Cup. And, you know, losing 3-0 in a friendly to Mexico after losing to them in the Gold Cup final. And there's a real feeling that the U.S. men's team needs to do a lot to reestablish itself as a legitimate team. And that may not happen until the next World Cup in Qatar by getting there and doing well. And there's more to lose than to gain tonight, if we're being honest, to the U.S. against Canada, because if they were to get beaten, especially, I think there would be a lot of negativity around this U.S. team.
How fundamental is Christian Pulisic to the kind of the future, the immediate future of this American side, Grant?
I mean, he was the best player during qualifying for the last World Cup as a teenager, and so he's the best U.S. player. He's obviously not playing a ton at Chelsea right now, but he's just getting started. I was bummed out, I guess, that during the last World Cup qualifying campaign, there were very few U.S. players between the ages of 24 and 28 who were helpful. You know, it's almost like there's a lost generation there.
Is there a reason for that? You know, I'm trying to kind of place that gap in terms of, you know, recent American football history. In theory, the players that age would have grown up in kind of a sweet spot, wouldn't they? In terms of, you know, where the 2002 World Cup, you know, there's been some successes in there.
Yeah, you would have thought that would be the case, but this was also the group that failed to qualify for the last two Olympic tournaments. And so there's something there that happened, and maybe it had to do with MLS not doing enough with their academies and their development process for a certain period of time. Maybe now they're doing a bit more, but those are kind of lost years. And so getting into the reasons why is a great question. I don't have all the answers, unfortunately.
Hey, Grant, one of the things that used to be a mark of the U.S. men's team as well, and I think kind of gave them a real edge on, certainly on the Canadian team, is they could count on a lot of players who were honing their craft in the Bundesliga or in the Premier League. But there has always seemed to be this route between U.S. and German teams and kind of a back and forth there. Does that still exist to the degree it did previously?
Well, Germany has clearly become the place to go in Europe for the best young American players, replacing England. You know, maybe a decade ago, you saw a lot more Americans going to England. That's mm-hmm. not the case now. And Germany has become this place where a lot of young players from around Europe go to because they're more willing to give young players playing time than you see in the Premier League. But I look back to the 2002 World Cup where the U.S. got to the quarterfinals, and the vast majority of that team came from MLS. So it's always going to have to be a mix of MLS players for the U.S. along with players in Europe. And there's stuff to build around there, whether it's Pulisic, Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams, Josh Sargent. But they are still young.
What do you think about this new qualifying system, the new HEX, you know, the CONCACAF HEX being based on a rating system rather than, you know, a straight up kind of play in head to head? It's probably not going to be an issue for the Americans getting in, but, you know, for Canada, where they're going to be hovering around, you know, 6, 7, 8 in those rankings probably. And I know the rankings are based on a formula, but, you know, it's still a ranking system. It's not a play-in. Not that we've had any luck playing our way in. but, you know, what do you think of this new recast system?
I think it's really unfortunate for whatever team is going to end up 7th in the CONCACAF rankings to have to face a much higher hill to climb to qualify for the World Cup as opposed to playing through a semifinal round. And I think it's pretty unfair. And, you know, we were seeing what's happening here with the CONCACAF Nations League replacing the semifinal round of qualifying. And I understand why the CONCACAF Nations League exists, but having something so important be determined by a ranking system that has been pretty unreliable over the years and can be gamed in terms of gaming the system, I just don't like.
Grant, we know that we're led to believe Jozy Altidore won't be available tonight. Michael Bradley will play. Who, these are two guys we're used to seeing as being sort of ever presence in the U.S. lineup. And Michael Bradley, I understand his relationship with the U.S. Soccer Association. It's been difficult. I mean, it gets filtered through a lot of familial concerns and things of that nature. But is there another sort of Michael Bradley there, the guy who is going to take over as sort of the heart and soul, the spokesman, the on-field leader of that team?
Tyler Adams is that guy for me. And he's obviously been hurt for several months now and is nearing a return to playing for RB Leipzig. But he comes right out and says he wants to be the captain of the U.S. men's national team, the senior team. And he does all these things to back it up, from his play to his leadership. And I don't think too many people inside that U.S. team argue with that. So once Tyler Adams gets back to a point where he's playing regularly for club and for country, I think you'll see him move into that role.
Grant, good stuff, man. Always great to talk to you. Thanks for this.
My pleasure. Take care.
Grant Wall of SI. And Planet Football, by the way, that's FUTBOL.
Yeah.
If you're a footy fan.
But they're kind of adrift, the Americans, you know. It's a funny time, and you would say this is an opportunity for Canada. And again, that would be great to win one on this stage, to have a, put up a result on this stage in a game that matters, because this does matter. In terms of those rating points, right? If you beat the Americans here, that's, you know, they're 6 points out of the sixth place right now, I think. Now, again, I'm not going to try and figure that system out for you, but
I love what John Herdman said. What we have to do is beat teams we haven't beaten in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so anytime you see Canada playing one of the big teams, Costa Rica, Mexico, or the U.S., well, they have to beat them.
Yeah,
I mean,
and they've got to beat the Jamaicas, and they've got to beat the El Salvadors, and they've got to beat the Honduras's and all of those other ones that are going to be potentially in the mix. Panama, you know, all of those countries mm-hmm. have played in the World Cup since we played in the World Cup. The Americans, though, you know, you wonder that if you roll back to the Jurgen Klinsmann experiment, you know, and what that did to American soccer, not for American soccer, but to American soccer. You know, at the moment, it seemed like the most progressive, smart thing to do, you know, hire mm-hmm. a guy who's you know, got a foot in both camps, lived in the States, but obviously had worked with Germany and coached Germany, great player. It didn't work. And, you know, they're still kind of recovering from that in some ways.
Yeah, it's, I'd love at some point to sit down with Michael Bradley and talk about it, because he's kind of been there through this, the whole thing. I mean, he was essentially booed off the pitch by U.S. fans at one point. They're it's an organization that's well-funded. Soccer in the United States is highly organized. It's a major college sport, both for men and women.
And the U.S. men's national team is a thing, right?
Way
more than here. Partially because they've been in World Cups. I've been with traveling American fans in World Cups, and you know, but they also turn out if they play a friendly against anybody significant.
There will be American fans here tonight,
and there'll be American fans here tonight.
For sure.
It's a thing. It's not like it's peripheral in the mm-hmm. States. People do care about it, and there's a, you know, really vibrant soccer culture there that, you know, is connected to the college game and MLS and all of that, but also, you know, around the men's national team. So, there's pressure on those guys in a way that, you know, honestly, the Canadian men's national team, and it's a function of their history, is an afterthought here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they got to, you know, and again, I think John would acknowledge that, Herdman would acknowledge that they've got to force themselves to not be an afterthought in this country.
Yeah,
and good luck to him.
Well, I'll tell you what, qualifying for the World Cup would be part of it. Would be a huge part of it. That would certainly get people's attention. Would change everything. But in the very least, you also beat. I cannot stress this enough. If this Canadian team beats the Americans tonight, again, think of those 34 years, 17 matches. That's a hell of a long time to not beat anybody. And if this Canadian men's team can beat the Americans tonight, maybe they will get people's attention. Maybe they'll get people's attention because they're exciting. They're not just simply going to kick the ball long. It's not route one. They're not going to line guys back, kick the ball down, and play for a, you know, try to get somebody
the
counter.
Well, the thing is, we know they're going to be
a tie.
We think they're going to be in the World Cup in 2026, although I don't think they've actually said all three hosts are going to get in. But we assume the expanded World Cup so Canada will be in the big show in 2026.
Right. It would be nice to actually qualify.
Yeah.
It would.
And, you know, and that would lead to a conversation towards 2026. So, yeah, getting in, look, it's a long time since Craig Forrest and company, you know.
Yeah. That was it or Newfoundland?
That was where the qualifier was.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. They should schedule all the qualifiers.
Of course,
in Newfoundland.
Yeah. Preferably in the middle of January.
Yes, indeed.
Coming up, well, the big question that Brent and myself have been debating, how much is it going to take to get me to wear a hot dog outfit?
Yes, sir. There are many options.
There are many options. Okay. How much will it take for me to be a mascot at the challenge, the Rec League Cup challenge, coming up? We'll find out. It's Blair. It's Brunt. This is the Writer's Block on the home of Tim and Sid and TV and radio, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, so we got to get to the bottom of this now. So you apparently know this know more about this than I do.
No, I don't. It's just taken on a life of its own.
All right, well,
if you deal with J.R. Diggs, that's what happens.
Let me set it up. And we've been plugging for a long time the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup. Which is an opportunity for a rec league hockey team to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center. Joe Bowen, Jim Roffle of the Call the Game after party, the whole thing. It's sponsored in conjunction with our friends at the beer store. So I just made a comment that, I'm not thinking anybody would pay attention to it, that maybe Brundtor, and then I said myself that go as mascots.
Yes.
Well, apparently J.R. Diggs, who is a friend of Brunt's, was he a local celebrity in Hamilton?
He was on national television late at night. He is a celebrity and as I always say, a force for good in Hamilton.
Yes, he does a lot of good stuff. He sent out an Instagram feed in which they're talking about raising money to have me
wear
a mascot suit. Now,
so he sent me the rules today.
Okay, these are the rules.
Okay, so this is the deal. Said Blair will wear a mascot outfit if we raise enough money, and it'll go directly to a local charity that we all support and can get behind. So JR is great for that. He raises a ton of money in Hamilton for worthy charities.
He's got the acoustic Christmas.
He is offering up a pair of acoustic Christmas tickets to the highest bidder.
Those are good. I mean, those are hard to
come
by. So
December 23rd, one of the great nights of the year. Who do we have last year? The Trues. Max Kerman, Tom Wilson, Gord Sinclair from the Hip, and other fantastic musicians. It's a great, great night on December 23rd.
And
Year it goes to a different Hamilton charity, okay. But it's always, on the ground, right?
Yeah,
it goes directly to something, really, really important in the city. The winner highest bidder gets to choose the mascot outfit Blair wears.
Oh, no, that's... Okay,
and the local charity where we will direct the dollars, assuming we approve of the beneficiary. So that's good. So they get to choose where the money goes. And again, I'm not sure where this selection of mascot costumes is going to come from. But
this would, as the go-between here, and there have to be some ground rules.
Well, I'm not sure. I think JR sets the rules here. As far as I know, we've turned over our lives to him. We're starting to get more stuff. They're going to sweeten the prize package. So there's going to be maybe a little meet and greet on December 23rd.
With who?
With you and me and at the Acoustic Christmas. And... he's sweetening the pot.
Okay, but does he have any costume ideas? This is the most...
Oh, I'm sure he has ideas.
I know that, but I mean, I will do this.
Well, you kind of have to now.
I will do this, but there have to be some ground rules for the costumes. I don't do body parts. I do not do body parts.
Okay.
In J.R. Diggs' Instagram post, there was a reference to my girth and a suggestion that I may want to lose weight because...
Did he say that?
Yeah, because it may not be fitting. I'm not doing a thin person's thing. So I'm not going as a carrot or something like that. It has to be... I mean, I will go as a Stay Puft Marshmallow, anything like that, but I am not going at all.
I think that's appropriate. Leaves up a wide range
enough,
of possibilities.
It's bad enough that every time Sid comes in or we run one of those Dr. Frank Listache commercials, I have to get jokes from Sid about male breast reduction. So, I mean, it's bad enough I put up with that every day. So I will not wear anything form-fitting.
Okay.
We're not doing body parts. Apparently eggplants are out, which, I don't get, but apparently eggplants are a thing.
How do people connect with since you are a social media maven? How should people connect with the great J.R. Diggs?
A hell of a lot of people, probably.
But they need to connect with J.R. Diggs. So where will they find him?
Where will they find J.R. Diggs?
Yes, because people need to be able to connect with him.
I mean, his Twitter handle.
Yes,
is J.R. at J.R. or that's his Twitter handle is J.R. Diggs.
Yeah,
all caps except for the I, which is lowercase. It doesn't matter. J.R. at JRDiggs.com.
Yeah,
so go there, we'll do this. But as I said, no body parts, nothing form fitting.
That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's going to be upping the ante with every with every bid here. There will be good things attached to it. Acoustic Christmas all by itself, very hard ticket to get. They sell out almost instantly. And
practically impossible.
And again, it's the coolest night of the year. It's one of my absolute favorite things. So if you like music, there'll be cool people playing in different configurations. You never know who's going to play with whom.
But you see my point. I should be able to have some say in the costume.
You will have. You've made your point. I think JR will abide by that, knowing them. He's a He will abide by that.
There are some.
He won't strip you of all your dignity. So
I'm not worried about being stripped. I'm actually being, you know.
JR, it's over to you again, pal. Again, this money, I guarantee you, the money will go to something worthwhile. And you can dictate that it goes to something worthwhile.
Absolutely.
It's your choice, as long as it's legit. JR is willing to, but support him in general, support Acoustic Christmas, and support whatever this turns into, whatever creature you turn into. I guess it could be a creature, a thing, could be any number of things.
All right. I've agreed that I will... I've agreed that I will do it.
Okay.
So I'm guessing we'll hear more from JR tomorrow.
JR Diggs,
I will do it. Unless, of course, it falls in a day in which I'm busy, in which case I'll probably send Brent along.
You've committed. No, you cannot uncommit.
I will do it. I will do it. So, JR, we got a deal. Let's make this happen. But please, no form fitting and no... I do demand, my only demand is at least the right of refusal for the... And Brent, you know my sense of humor. Mm-hmm. It has to be pretty bad for me to refuse anything.
That's true.
So I get at least the right of first refusal. But yes, we got a deal there. You're experiencing writer's block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360. Oh, we've got to break a 55. So I rushed through that for nothing.
You did. I was thinking, I don't hear music in my ears. Why do I not hear music in my ears?
This is this new clock.
Anyway, we've got 3 minutes. We can talk about the ball game last night. Because we're gonna
have Duquette on.
We're gonna morph
minutes.
Into baseball in the next hour for a little bit, but
that is
classic
like,
playoff performance, Steven Strasburg. Huh? Listen, that's one of those ones where you think, boy, this is pick your throwback moment, Jack Morris, anybody you want in the postseason, where a pitcher just comes in and says, "I'm the boss tonight. No one's gonna beat me, and you're not gonna get me out of here until I'm done." I thought that was spectacular last night.
The scary thing about last night, watching Steven Strasburg work. And, you know, look, I think we've all been saying all along that it's going to come down to Houston or the Yankees. And I still think the American League team will be favored coming out.
Yep.
There's no doubt about it. But watching what Sanchez, Scherzer, and Strasburg have done, understanding that the way the schedule looks, they could very well be rested going into World Series if they can wrap it up tonight.
Mm-hmm. Makes things interesting.
Well, it's going to be infinitely more interesting than I think a lot of us thought it would be. And just the Washington story is amazing.
As
Dan Shulman said, Davey Martinez was within 48 hours of being fired as manager.
Yeah.
Of the Washington Nationals.
I got to say, I'm less enthused about future Blue Jay Marcelo Ozuna after last night as well.
Well, you noticed that was...
That's kind of the defining moment of the game as well.
Yeah. I think we Jays fans will probably say they've taken care of any of the issues in left field, that we really did not want to see Marcelo Ozuna out there. But I think the thing all along with Marcelo Ozuna was get him in. He'll be an impactful bat in the middle of the order. And if he has to DH, he has to DH.
Yeah. He only DH'd one guy, though.
Yeah, but I would take him over the other options, unless Vladdy's one of those options.
Yeah.
But anyhow. That is, I never thought, I thought that the Nats would win this series. No way did I think they'd be in a position to sweep. So there you go. Cards and Nats tonight at 8 o'clock. Astros Yankees at 4 p.m. He mentioned Jim Duquette of the MLB Network will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Unconfirmed sources say this is the best show in the history of sports radio.
You're simply the best.
This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt.
Better than all the rest.
On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, in about an hour's time, the Astros and Yankees are scheduled to start Game 3 of that series at 4 o'clock on Sportsnet. Cards and Nats at 8 p.m. on Sportsnet. A chance for the Washington Nationals to sweep the St. Louis Cardinals and advance to the World Series, something that I don't think anybody necessarily foresaw at any point this season. But my goodness, the pitching that that the Washington Nationals are running out, as we said before the break, I've been operating under the assumption that that the Astros and Yankees are going to, one of them will win the World Series. I still think they'll be favorites, but boy, oh boy, the Washington Nationals got my attention.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think that game, because with Anibal Sanchez, because that does that in game one, it changes that entire series.
Completely.
Right? Because otherwise you're just talking about the two guys, and the two guys could be amazing. But, you know, getting four wins out of two guys is going to be hard. But that, the fact that not just that they won that first game, but how they won, that he just completely shut them down. So you got the Cardinals on their back foot. Mm. Right off the hop there, and you know, and then look what's coming. It is, you know, we've seen like those actually, you know, those three back to back to back, those three starting pitching performances. I'm not sure how many I've seen that are better. You know, the first three games of a best of seven.
No, I was trying to think back to some of the pitching performances I've seen. I don't remember anything being as dominant. I mean, generally somebody flukes out a run here and there, but mm-hmm. the Cardinals are fluking out a run.
Yeah, well, you know, the one last night was, you know, like it, they was unearned, right? And and they, you know, it's turned the St. Louis or the Washington bullpen into a moot point, right?
Exactly. Like,
haven't really seen them.
Jim Duquette of MLB Network Radio, former Major League General Manager with the Mets and Orioles, joined Stephen Brunt and myself in Writer's Block. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today. I mean, Brunt and I were just talking about, I don't know how you put what the Nationals have done into so far in this series into context historically, but just to the eye, Jim, never mind the numbers, but to the eye, I don't know if I've seen a team figure out another team at the plate the way Washington's figured out the Cardinals. I mean, they made Paul Goldschmidt look like a really, 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 really bad hitter, and that's hard.
It's hard to do. It really is. He struck out four times last night. Ozuna had a couple of hits, but Ozuna, you know, had swung it well in the first couple of games. You know, if you go back to the DS, you kind of get the sense that the Cardinals' offense is only built around those middle two guys, and maybe Tommy Edman, the rookie. No one else is really doing that much overall in that series. So, you know, unless somebody figured it out quickly, which they haven't against the Nationals pitching, like you're saying, this offense has gone flat. And those guys in middle lineup, they've gone flat too. It's almost like you would have expected them to cool off a little bit. So I didn't expect it to be this bad offensively. And I had a chance to talk to Mike Shield about it. Their manager, the last couple of games, like, hey, I got to change the lineup. You know, there's always that. Do you stick with the lineup that got you there? Do you go with the same one, even though they're struggling? I thought he should have at least changed it up more yesterday. He didn't, and it really didn't help.
Jim, watching Strasburg dominate, you know, and again, he's still got a plus fastball, but a guy to dominate and strike so many guys out with, you know, either the curveball or the changeup with off speed stuff. Again, I'm not sure I've ever seen a guy have that kind of a strikeout performance where that, you know, it was so much based on his off-speed stuff. And again, you know, at some point in that game, they know it's coming, and there's nothing they can do about it. They made them helpless. Have you, you know, you got a point of comparison for that?
I don't. It's funny because, you know, just watching how he did it, and I think he had like 15 called strikes in the curveball. That's unheard of, really. Like, that's a ton. You know, not only did he throw a ton of curveballs and changeups, he had, I think, 33% swing and miss on the changeup. But he didn't have as many in the swing and miss on the other pitches. But, I mean, he really did a great job of mixing his pitches. He threw three changeups in a row at times. Yeah, that's what he struck Fowler out the second time around. It was just a really masterful performance. And to me, that's what's separated him from – you know, the old Strasburg is, you know, the fastball velocity is not where it was mid-90s, high 90s. It's still, let's say, 93, 94 in that range, 95. But he has the ability to throw all those other pitches for strikes whenever he wants it. He's pitching. You know, they talk about with Gerrit Cole, like Gerrit Cole's doing the same thing, and it's just an elite off the charts level. But I got to tell you, watching Strasburg, it's not that far away from what Gerrit Cole's been doing with the Astros. Mm.
Yeah, no, it's amazing to see a guy who's, you know, he's parked the slider, doesn't throw it anymore. You know, he was pumped up in that first inning, and he was kind of 96, 97, but as you say, settled back into 93, 94. But that's the best curveball. I'm not sure, you know, again, you think of kind of great curveballs in the past, guys you've seen who are masters of it, but I'm not sure I've seen anybody throw it as often in so many situations to so many different guys and watch guys miss it by a foot. You know, it wasn't close. Right. Like, those weren't competitive at bats.
No, they really weren't. I mean, you know, and he'll throw, you know, how many times did he throw 3-2 breaking balls for caught looking, right? You know, it just seemed like he's able to do it back-to-back. The guy that he reminds me of just a little bit, and just having the command of the curveball was Pedro. Because Pedro had those great curveballs as well. He had a great changeup. Obviously, the size is different, physically. But that's the only other guy that really kind of stands out that, you know, could throw as many, you know, off-speed pitches. That it's such a field pitch, and we're used to seeing so much power. And Strasburg has power to his game, too. But, yeah, that's the power and finesse is a unique blend, and Strasburg definitely has it.
Hey Jim, if they can wrap this up tonight, does being able to give Scherzer and Strasburg and Sanchez and Corbin and everybody, being able to give them a pretty good rest going into the World Series, could that be enough to overcome the fact that, look, whoever comes out of the American League is going to be heavily favored. Whoever comes out of the American League has got a better lineup, I think. Whoever comes out of the American League has a better bullpen. Will that rest alone be enough to maybe strengthen Dave Martinez's hand?
Well, it definitely helps. I can tell you, Scherzer in particular was out of gas and has been. He said that to us the other day. And watching him pitch in Game 4 of the Dodgers, he knew that his start in Game 2 in the LCS – he's like, you know what, throwing a no, because he had, you know, inklings of a no hitter just like Sanchez did, but he's like, you know, it's gonna take me 140 pitches to get there. Is what he told us yesterday. So he wasn't gonna be allowed to go to that number. So I do think that, you know, the time off for them is gonna help. It definitely hurts the hitters taking time off. We've seen that over time with that kind of layoff, but I feel like the pitching can overcome it. It's just I would say. I know it's a long-winded answer to say it can definitely help them, but it also, for me, depends on how deep the next series goes. So, you know, if the Astros goes seven games, the Astros win. You know, game 6 and 7, it's going to be, what, Verlander and Cole.
Right.
And so having them pitch on, you know, games 3 and 4, let's say in the back end, is a huge advantage for the Nationals, even if they have that time off. So, you know, that part of it, I do think, you know, it kind of remains to be seen how much of an advantage it'll be with the extra rest.
Jim, the forecast in New York tomorrow is not optimal, to say the least.
Right.
Does that – look, I don't think that'll play into anybody's hands necessarily tonight, but how could that end up having an impact on the Yankees-Astros series? Does anybody profit from that more than the other?
You know what, for me, I look at it, so right now they're both scheduled to do bullpen games, right, and go with their bullpen tomorrow. Now, if they get rained out, you know, what happens? Do they go to, you know, do they both go to starters? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm not sure. I think that a bullpen game in general, without an off day, which is what they would do, they'd lose the off day, I think it hurts the Yankees a little bit more because they're going to their bullpen a little earlier. That's the one advantage with Houston, I think.
That's an interesting decision, though, isn't it? You know, think about that, whether you would, you know, because, you know, you could obviously, you can go back to your, you know, you could go back to your game one starter.
Right.
You know, but a bullpen day with no day off, that's a really interesting, I know not managers don't make these decisions on their own. That is an organizational decision, and there's probably a whole lot of cooks in that one. But, you know, I'm wondering what you do if that happens. Like, what's... Is there a right or a wrong? I'm not sure there is, but it's a tricky one.
I don't know. Yeah, it's tricky. You haven't been in that spot, you know, that all that much. I would say this: more times than not, I would go back to the starter, save your bullpen for, you know, another day.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I say that is because, okay, at some point, you know, let's say Tanaka gets his start, 2 days from now, he's going to factor in your bullpen. know, and you'd be able to use him out of the bullpen. And then another day, your next starter, Paxton can pitch out of the bullpen on his throw day. So I feel like that pushing that, you know, a little further away, you get a little bit of an advantage in that sense. But I don't know, it's a tough call, but I tell you, it's both teams went with the extra pitchers, and Yankees, I think, went with one less position player. It's kind of hurting them a little bit with Stanton on the shelf there with quad. But they did it because, you know, they had this in mind. So I would say at the end, likely that the Astros would get the benefit of that, you know, just again, because they have starters that can go six or seven or eight innings, which I know you guys have seen this too, but I'm a little surprised we've seen so many starters go seven or more innings. Like, we've already surpassed what we saw all last postseason, and the starters going deeper in the games. And, you know, I think not necessarily we're seeing a buck in the trend, but it kind of speaks to how these teams were built that are still in it.
Yeah, I think it speaks to those individuals, doesn't it? Like, they're kind of throwbacks, right? in a way. That's kind of throwback playoff baseball, but those are throwback starters, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, right. That's exactly right. And, you know, it's like, all right, well, even last night, I mean, when's the last time we all felt that Steven Strasburg could go 117 pitches? Like,
yeah.
Never. You know, yeah. Very, very rarely, you know. And he's one of those guys that used to be perfect, had to be perfect to stay out there. You know, he got squeezed on the pitch in the seventh there with Martinez, and usually that disrupted his outing. But he overcame that. You know, he ended up going, well beyond where I thought, most people thought. So I think he's kind of shed that number two starter label. I think you could consider him a number one now.
Yeah, you know, I was saying to Jeff earlier, it was like a Jack Morris thing, you know, where you almost were going to, like vintage Jack Morris, drag him off the mound at your own peril, right? He wasn't leaving until he got the last out in that inning.
That's a great comparison, you know, and Jack's name came up when Anibal Sanchez threw his kind of six-inning no-hitter back 6 years ago. Jack was like, this is nothing. You know, back in the day, I would have been throwing 150 pitches, and he's right. He would have been doing that.
So. Hey, Jim, according to at least what we've been able to see on MLB Network, and I have not gone on Twitter to check this, but Giancarlo Stanton's not in the lineup tonight. Aaron Hicks is in, batting ninth. Look, they're a superior defensive team, I think, with Aaron Hicks in the game, but what's up with Stanton, and are we at the point now where if you're the Yankees, you have some concerns about his availability for the rest of the series or even going into the World Series if you go there?
So, yeah, I think you're right. He's not in the lineup again today. I think what their hope was is that, you know, potentially with that rain out tomorrow, that he'd be ready to go, you know, 2 days from now. You know, it's hard because, you know, the rule, as you guys know, it's like, all right, well, if you put him on the injured list this series, you lose him for next two. So you're going to lose him for the World Series. So they're trying to manage it as best they can, kind of like what the Nationals did on a lesser scale with Victor Robles. He took 2 days off of the first two games of the series, and then he played last night and hit a home run. So I think they're hopeful that you know, in a couple of days, Stanton will be better. And like I said, they're short position player wise. So, you know, Hicks is in there, and you know, unless you're going to pinch hit Stanton, he's kind of useless to you for another day. So I know there's a lot of frustration in Yankee land, as you guys can expect. But, you know, the fact that they haven't put him on the injury list kind of gives me hope that we'll see him in a couple of days.
Jim, I want to ask you one kind of non-playoff related question here. There's, what, a million managerial vacancies right now? Nine managerial vacancies in baseball.
Eight or nine, yeah.
Which is a crazy number. There's I've gone through every list where, you know, people are speculating on candidates that are teams acknowledging or not acknowledging guys, people who may or may not be in the conversation, may or may not be interviewed. John Gibbons is a very popular guy in this town. At the end of his managerial tenure, he was beloved, which doesn't happen very often. Usually they run you out of town. Stints here, got the team back to the postseason. His name, I saw his name floated as kind of an outsider candidate with the Mets, but that's it. If you don't get a job or don't get a bite when there are nine jobs open, what's that say?
Yeah, I think it does make you wonder if, you know, he's going to get another opportunity or not on that. Gibby, and I love Gibby. I've known him. He and I were together in the Mets in 1991 when I first started. He was a roving catching instructor, so I've known him that long. I thought he was our best managerial candidate coming up through the minors. But, you know, my sense was towards the end when we would talk to him on my show, you know, and he was still managing in Toronto. It's like, yeah, you know what? I liked managing, but I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't give you, if you're another general manager, like, oh, this guy doesn't want it. You're like, okay, does he have the burning desire to do it or not? He's like, no, Gibby. He's like, he's home on his ranch fishing and ordering pizza for, you know, lunch and dinner. And you know, that makes him lovable. You know, he's a simple guy. And it's like, okay, well, if it comes my way, then I'll take it. But I don't think he's necessarily promoting himself or he has somebody doing it for him. And that's what I think these other guys do. You know, these other guys, they want it more. They seem to want it more. They have people in their corner kind of pushing, you know, calling on their behalf. I don't know if they're going to get jobs or not. You know, Girardi, Buck, Showalter, Dusty Baker. But they're at least in the ring, you know. And I'd love to see Gibby get in the ring because I think he would impress some teams. But one of us three can go and
yeah,
and do that for him.
I think we could all be – yeah, well – we can be his agents because, you know, I think there's a lot of love for Gibby in this room. And I can tell listening to Jim that how much you like him. It's hard. Yeah, we love the guy. But, you know, I think that's – I was talking to somebody about this, you know, the hiring process in hockey, a different sport. But that idea that, you know, you want guys – you almost need your name out there as a candidate in order to be a candidate. You know, it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. So you need to be talked about. So somebody says, hey, what about that guy that everybody's talking about? And Gibby's not good at – he is not a great self-promoter. I would say that is not one of his greatest skills.
Right. Well, no, that's exactly it. And, you know, I know from experience, because I've hired four different managers, I'm looking at candidates. I'm like, all right, come on, guys. Who else can we look at? You start looking at who was at least interviewed the last time there was a managerial opening around the league. And you go start looking at that list. You're like, okay, that's an interesting name. All right, I'm going to fire these two guys into the mix. So, you know, to your point, like, if you want to stay in the game managing, kind of throw your hat in the ring in one of these jobs, even if maybe they're not interested in it. It keeps your name circulating with other clubs until the right fit comes along.
Jim, we appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
All right, guys, you got it. Have a good one.
Thanks, Jim. Bye.
Jim Duquette is MLB Network Radio baseball analyst, former general manager with the Mets and the Orioles. And Yandina, he worked with John Gibbons when Jim Duquette was with the Mets. This thing's kind of weird, though, because, you know, as you and Jim were talking about that, I never thought Dusty Baker would get another sniff at a managing job either. And Dusty Baker's name is. Dusty's got more than enough people in the game who would be willing to float his name for him.
Yeah,
so that's number one. Number two,
there have been some jobs, like there's no real swirl around the Royals job, for instance, right mm-hmm. now. You know, and Gibby has a bit of history with that organization. He was a bench coach there. I don't know if that would carry over at all. John Lott did a piece where he interviewed Gibby recently, Gibby said, yeah, I'd like to manage again. And I said that I've approached some teams and kind of put my name out there. I think he would also like to coach. Mm-hmm. I think he wants to get back in the game.
I think he would be a terrific bench coach.
Yeah. That's what he was for Kansas City, Clint Hurdle, right?
Yeah. In Kansas City. He was the bench coach in Kansas City. It was Trey, what was his name? It was
I'm trying to remember who the manager was. Anyway,
who came over from.
When he got hired back here, he was reasonably happily managing a double-A team in his hometown, San Antonio, mm-hmm. Sleeping in his own bed half the time. You know, I think Kenny was pretty content. You know, he's not going to be anybody's idea of the new school cutting-edge manager, but you know what? There's a bunch of guys in the mix right now.
Oh, that's what I said. Dusty.
The pendulum's swinging a little bit, isn't it?
Well, it's odd. I never thought I'd see Dusty Baker get a chance at managing again, given the way the game has gone. Trey Hillman was the manager of the Kansas City Royals when John Gibbons was the bench coach. John Gibbons would be a terrific bench coach. He really would. But having said that, you know, some of the other things, the thing that I find fascinating is Sam Fuld, who is the Philadelphia Phillies, he's like their statistics coordinator guy, former major leaguer. He's a hot commodity.
Mm-hmm.
He's turned down offers to interview in three places, including San Diego. Now, maybe he's got his eye on the Phillies job, which is fine.
Yeah.
But.
Although that's all in the owner's hands there, right? Like, that's a total crapshoot.
That is a total crapshoot. But it's fascinating how Raul Ibanez, mm-hmm. the guy we've heard of, he is he pulled his name out of consideration for jobs. A lot of the highly touted managerial candidates in baseball, and maybe this is because guys are retiring younger now and they're getting in the game and they realize,
yeah,
I can make a good living without having to put the uniform on and go in the dugout. But a lot of younger guys are being way more picky about where they want to go than guys in the past. Like, it'd be interesting to ask Charlie Montoya, would you have been picky?
I'm not going to speak for Charlie, but a guy, you know, he spent so much time managing in the minor leagues with great success. He did get to a point where he was a bench coach. I'm not sure he had a ton of opportunities before he got there. And he was a bit of a dark horse here, right? He was the mm-hmm. last guy they interviewed. And they were convinced to interview him by some other people saying, you should talk to Charlie Montoya. His name wasn't out there, right? Like, remember, they were the five finalists for the job, allegedly. He wasn't on that list.
Yeah.
So, you know, number one, there's stuff happening that that media speculation doesn't cover. But you would think with 9 gigs, like, those are 9 very different situations. Mm-hmm. Like, the difference between being the Cubs manager or being the Phillies manager or being the Royals manager, you're different universes there, right? Yeah. San Diego's with that young team coming
different
on.
Different universes, like, different expectations.
Yeah. That San Diego job seems to me to be a win-win. It's pretty, you know, it's going to get better.
Yeah.
Right? It's going to get better there.
Yeah. If it was me, that would be my preferred job. Plus, you're living in San Diego. How bad will that be? Coming up, the Leafs and the Minnesota Wild play tonight at 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, Luke Fox of Sportsnet, joins us to break it down. The Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunn on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and on TV on Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder, your team could be playing in a game called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph, live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan for the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup. Your team was nominated. We've been asking you to tune in every weekday to hear if we announce it. And if you're not nominated, you can still enter online for a chance to be the wild card team. Rob Anderson from Whitby nominated the team JD Trailer Flyers, captained by himself. If you're on the team, if you're on the JD Trailer Flyers, you have 590 seconds to call us at 416-870-0590, star 590, 1-888-666-0590, to qualify for the voting round of the contest. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. Find out how to win at sportsnet.ca/590. Do-do-do. Minnesota Wild are in Toronto to take on the Leafs tonight at 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Luke Fox of Sportsnet is at the Leafs morning skate today. Joins us on Writer's Block. Hello, Mr. Fox.
How are you, Jeff?
We are doing well. So the Minnesota, your article in the Wild kind of sent a shock, or didn't send a shock, it sent a shiver down my back in a lot of ways. I think for any rebuilding team, the Minnesota Wild are really a cautionary tale, aren't they? When you look at a team that, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about when do you rebuild, when don't you rebuild. Boy, the Minnesota Wild, you want to talk about a team that took a big swing and missed. It is the Wild, isn't it?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, when they signed those twin 13-year, $98 million deals to Ryan Suter and Zach Parise that one summer, it was ownership, management saying, we're all in. And, you know, it sent a jolt through the fan base. I remember they were selling at the building. People were amped up that they finally had a contender. You know, at the time, Parise was one of the more dynamic and responsible scorers in the league, and Ryan Suter, no one really questioned his worth as a defenseman. But then, you know, it didn't happen. You know, their window was the same time as the Kings and the Blackhawks window, and they never got very far. And I think their main problem was they kept chasing it. And even as recently as this summer, I was scratching my head when they signed Matt Zuccarello, who's, you know, one of those guys where you love the player, but you hate the contract, giving 5 years and $30 million to a guy who's who's past his prime, just shows you that there's still this thirst to contend, but the roster just isn't there. I mean, their leading scorer right now is a defenseman by the name of Brad Hunt, who has 4 points. They're not getting scoring from any of their forwards, so they're going to be in tough tonight.
So, and where, you know, in kind of on the curve then, Luke, aside from being awful right now, which they are, as you say, you know, that like you're kind of stuck betwixt and between, right? You're not even that. You're still kind of a victim of what you tried to do in the past, and are lousy in the present. And it's going to be a while before you get good, right? Like you can't even put a directional arrow on this thing right now.
No, you can't. I mean, a few of us reporters were having this conversation, and we were kind of wondering, is there a cap situation, roster situation that is worse off than Minnesota? And it's harsh to say that, but, you know, you look at Ottawa, and there's a lot of nice prospects to talk about. You look at the Rangers, you know, and they took a lot of heat for making that reset public a couple years ago. And, you know, people were wondering about how much they had tied up in Henrik Lundqvist, but they sold their assets and they got some youth in there, and they're turning things around quite nicely. Whereas the Minnesota Wild, you know, they could have rented out Eric Staal at the deadline last year. Instead, they re-signed him for more years. And it's nothing against Eric Staal. He's a great player. He's been a great leader. He doesn't have a goal this year. And there's no sense that he's going to improve next year. But you keep committing term to guys that are older, and they haven't drafted and developed well. I mean, their problems are different than the problems, say, in Winnipeg, where they're having cap problems because they have so many guys. It's how do we sign all these guys? Their problems are they keep leaning on the old guys because they haven't drafted and developed the young guys to kind of take that mantle. I mean, it was supposed to be Granlin and Niederreiter, and they ended up trading both those guys away because they were the only guys they could get value from.
Are they the oldest team in the league? They're one of the oldest, right?
Yeah, they're second oldest. I think it depends on the night, but their average age is over 29, and the Leafs, I believe, are the fourth or fifth youngest.
Wow.
So it just goes to show you that also there's a youth movement underfoot right now, and it's hard for these older teams to compete.
That's a striking number, because the median age in the league now is like 23 and a half or something. Isn't that right, Luke? It's yeah. Really, so to be 29 is way out of step with where the league is.
Yeah, it is. And there's still, the problem is there's still term. I mean, thank goodness that, you know, if Leaf fans are listening and they're worried that they could get into these problems, that you can't hand out 13-year contracts anymore. So that's one good thing, that they capped it at 8. Because there's still so many years left on those deals. The only guy that's going to be UFA is their captain, Mikko Koivu, who's been one of the premier two-way centers in the league, but he's lost a step as well. So it's just going to be a long road, I think, back. And the sooner they realize that and start trying to make moves, trying to find ways, it's a tough task, but I think you just have to realize the reality and try to get out from under it.
Hey, Luke, what do you think explains the slow offensive start for Marner and Tavares's line? Is it simply Zach Hyman, or is there anything else at work there?
No, I think that's a bit harsh on Kapanen to just, you know, say Hyman, they need Hyman to make those two work. I mean, you look at their salaries, you look at their career history, those guys should be enough to produce. I think it's just, the main thing I think is it's a small sample size. You know, I think we'll all be quiet if they explode for 3 points each tonight or something like that. But I think there is an element of Hyman. I do think that when he gets back, that line will move a bit smoother, but maybe there's some pressure here. I know one thing for Marner is he's been shooting a lot more, and that was kind of a goal of his, to become more of a dual threat, and it's something on his mind. But it's almost come to the point where I think he should be back to passing more and setting guys up. I mean, that's his his forte. You know, maybe there's an element of stuff being in his head with, you know, internal pressure that he's putting on himself now that he's making so much money. Maybe there's an element of that. Maybe Tavares, it's in his head a little bit about the captaincy. When you talk to them, though, they say that they're not worried at all, that this is just a small bump and this is the nature of hockey and just keep plugging away and the goals will come. But it is kind of interesting that 5-on-5, those guys haven't been producing at nowhere near the rate they were last year.
Good stuff, Luke. Thanks, man.
Okay. Have a great night, guys.
Take care. Luke Fox of Sportsnet. Again, Leafs and Wild, 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and on Sportsnet. Luke's piece is fascinating because – boy, oh boy, you read it and you want to talk about a team in cap hell.
Yep.
Like that's a team that's
self-created.
Yeah.
You know what? We always talk about signing guys and extending and holding on. Biggest thing in a cap system is you have to draft and develop well because you have to have those guys coming in on entry-level contracts. They have to be able to play and they have to play significant roles. You can't do it.
No, there has to be an assembly line. You literally have to bring in two new players every year to really cost-effective players. The other thing, too, and again, I direct your attention to Luke's article on Sportsnet.ca. It's really fascinating because it's a great franchise. I mean, I've gone to games there. It is a great arena. It's one of the best arenas in the NHL. It's a big-time hockey city. It's a big-time hockey market. And they just haven't been able to get the formula right. And as Luke points out, one of the issues is it's also a matter of timing. I mean, they had the grave misfortune of being in the toughest division in the NHL. The Chicago Blackhawks were really good for a lot of years. You know, the St. Louis Blues, of course, won the Stanley Cup. You got to have a lot go your way in addition to all your best laid plans. But that's frightening, Steve. Mm-hmm. 29 years old.
Yep.
29 years
old. Not going to change anytime soon.
That's average age.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's not. No, it's going to... We'll be having this conversation, well, if we're talking about them, several years from now still. They'll be digging themselves out of that for a while.
And I remember when they signed Parise and Suter at the time, it was kind of a different time. The reaction was, obviously the reaction to the term was shocking. But people looked at it and thought, you know, here's a team that has no money issues, the big market, they're making a statement. These are local guys, Zach Parise's father, J.P. Parise, mm-hmm. a much beloved Minnesota North Star player. So I think the idea was that you were making a good faith attempt with your
Correct.
Fans.
Yep.
But I...
Don't listen to the fans.
Well, not necessarily all the time. We started the show talking about LeBron James and his comments on Daryl Morey and Daryl Morey's tweet on Hong Kong and the fuss that created for the NBA in China. I've been lucky enough to have been in a couple of LeBron scrums during the postseason. And I'm a big believer that when you've been in a scrum for, and you've seen a guy a couple of times, you do kind of, you start to at least look at their body language a bit and take a, you know, and sort of see what they're saying through that filter. I've seen clips of LeBron James's scrum yesterday. And Steve, to your point, one of the things that surprised me, I don't think he looked uncomfortable talking about it. I don't think he looked uncomfortable talking about it. And that kind of gets to your point about about what he said.
Well,
and the significance.
It's kind
of
hard to parse it logically. What he said was that, you know, that Daryl Morey shouldn't, you know, that he kind of suggested.
There's no parsing.
He said he didn't, that Daryl Morey didn't understand or wasn't educated on the subject and then said later in this thing that he wasn't educated on the subject. So he didn't feel free to comment on the subject. And in the meantime, seem to be worrying about the financial interests of the National Basketball Association overall, over everything else. So I'd say he made things worse, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm. We weren't in the scrum, but Ben Golliver of the Washington Post was. Ben Golliver's coming up. This is The Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
I can't believe it.
Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet 360. Brandale, you're hitting it out of the park with music today on the radio side, by the way.
It's always tough when I feel like just singing along to the song, you know, instead of... Right, I'm not going to sing it.
And if you're watching on television, you have no idea.
No, I know. I said that. I covered myself.
It's the generic stuff on TV. Right?
Said on TV, right, that they're not hearing that. They're just looking at us.
Hearing things we don't have to pay for.
Believe me, you're missing good stuff.
Or that we've already paid for.
You're missing good stuff on the music side. Wild and Leaf, 7 o'clock tonight. It's on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It is not on Sportsnet, as I mistakenly said. Astros and Yankees, 4 p.m. on Sportsnet. Cards, Nats, 8 p.m. on Sportsnet. And Flyers and Flames tonight, 9 o'clock on Sportsnet.
Loads of stuff.
360.
Don't have to.
Tons of stuff. Tons of baseball.
Isolate yourselves from the world. And
I was not at, neither of us were at LeBron James's news conference yesterday in Los Angeles. And as I said before my little break, you know, someone who's been a reporter for a long time, I really do think you need to get a sense of what a guy looks like and what a guy, sort of what his body language is when you're in the middle of a scrum when the person's talking about something important to really find out sort of what his comfort level is on it. All I've seen is video of the scrum, and I'm interested, or we were interested in getting point of view of somebody who was in the scrum and is probably... talk to LeBron and kind of understand some of the signals you send out. Because athletes do. When you scrum them, there's signals guys send out. Mm-hmm. There's signals guys send out. Some of them can just be a look. Some of them can basically be a glare. Ben Golver of the Washington Post, as I mentioned, was in the scrum. He joins us on Writer's Block. So, Ben, you've done a lot of scrums with LeBron, a few scrums with LeBron. Is that any different body language, comfort level? Did you sense anything different yesterday in his comments about Daryl Morey and the NBA's issues in China?
You know, not at all. And, you know, he wasn't playing yesterday, so it was almost kind of his choice to do the media availability, and they did it pregame, which is a little bit unusual. Of course, there was an incredible amount of interest from people locally, and all the reporters who had gone to China were waiting to hear from him because, you know, all the media was canceled in China. He came through in very confident, calm fashion like he usually does. It seemed like, you know, he was kind of thinking in the back of his mind, hey, I've got this. I know the messages that I kind of want to hit. And he was doing fine for like the first 5 minutes. And then, you know, things kind of went sideways towards the end when he was, you know, trying to find the right way to take issue with Daryl Morey's tweet. And I'm not sure he ever found exactly the right wording. I think his real intention was to just, you know, push back and say, look, the timing was wrong. He didn't think through the consequences that it would have on his fellow NBA employees, you know, being the Lakers and the Nets who were in China and Morey wasn't. I think that's what he was trying to get across. But, you know, it didn't really happen. And to me, the biggest tell of everything was once the press conference was over, it was only a matter of minutes before he put out the two follow-up tweets trying to clean things up a little bit because he was getting an immediate pushback, you know, people saying that he was selling out to China and all those kinds of criticisms. And it's very rare, if not unprecedented, for, you know, LeBron James to do that kind of damage control. Usually when he says something, he stands by it. He doesn't back down. And in this case, it was a situation where he realized he'd stepped in it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, he had time to, as you alluded to, Ben, he had time to think about this, right? This was not being caught off guard. There was a fair bit of time to think about it. So I assume that he and whoever he might talk to, that they planned this, right? That they thought, said, what should we say? This is what he wanted to say. I'm not sure. Again, if you parse the statement, it's... well, it didn't help the situation. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I definitely think he communicated a number of things that he had planned to say. I mean, one of them was that he is not educated on the Hong Kong issue, and he's not passionate about it. And usually he likes to speak out when he really does care about an issue rather than talking about something that he doesn't really know about. It was clear that that was something he wanted to get across. It was also clear he wanted to get across support for Adam Silver, who had met with the players, you know, personally, you know, face to face in China to try to handle this situation. And, you know, his relationship, his close friendship, I think, with Adam Silver goes back a long way. And so he certainly went into that press conference trying to express that message as well. But I think that he is not alone among players who are just annoyed that it's Daryl Morey who caused this incident and who feel like there's a double standard in terms of how an executive might be treated for this kind of a brouhaha, which has a potential to cost, you know, the NBA millions of dollars, and how players might be treated
for much smaller infractions, whether it's like flopping or, you know, yelling at a referee or cursing or whatever it might be. I think they feel targeted to a certain degree, both financially with fines and suspensions, but also just, you know, from a PR perspective where they have to see the headline saying these guys are being punished. And I do think there's a sentiment among NBA players who are like, wait a minute, how can Daryl Morey create this kind of a controversy and face no discipline from the NBA, especially when his role in it created such a, you know, a tough and tricky situation for those teams that were in China. And I understand Adam Silver's response to that would be, look, we're going to stand up for our employees. I'm going to be the boss and handle this the right way. I'm going to defend his freedom of expression and do what I would do for any other employee. But you can see why the players would be looking a little bit sideways. And I think LeBron probably felt some level of responsibility as the most vocal and high-profile player to get that message out. And I just don't think it landed properly. I think he kind of butchered that.
Yeah, look, I can understand that to a point, Ben. But, you know, the comparables are, you know, the tweet on its face is innocuous. The content of the tweet is something that, you know, in itself, most people would support in general. And the consequences, the negative consequences for the players in the league were purely financial. So it, you know, it like the notion that Daryl Morey did this somehow selfishly, and the way it reads is, and you cost us money. That's it's hard not to read it that way.
Oh, no question. And look, let's not be naive. I mean, there's a lot of money at stake, right? I mean, you've got LeBron who said during the press conference that he's been to China 15 to 20 times in his life on various, whether it's to play basketball or to promote things. He also hinted that some of the Lakers players had individual, whether it's business meetings or events that they weren't able to go to. They either got canceled or just, you know, were basically put on the back burner because of the controversy that was stirred up. And, you know, this wasn't just like, let's go over to China and play two games. I mean, this is like a major business trip for a lot of these guys, especially LeBron. So you throw in the fact that he's got Space Jam 2 coming out. That's probably going to be a global release, and he's going to be looking to have that be one of the, you know, biggest paydays probably of his career, especially from an entertainment standpoint. And then you put the NBA on top of it. You know, they've got a $1 billion-plus deal with Tencent in China, all the sponsorship deals that the Rockets have that are currently on the line. It's absolutely a gigantic, you know, financial kind of power play and staring contest between the NBA and the Chinese authorities. And I just think somebody in LeBron's perspective, because he's admitted he doesn't care that much about the Hong Kong issue, he's looking at this, you know, basically from a pragmatic financial standpoint only. And I think that's what's led to such, you know, severe backlash. I mean, we've heard from Hong Kong protesters who told one of my colleagues at the Washington Post, you know, in Hong Kong, basically how disappointed and let down they feel by LeBron, you know, for not, you know, being interested in their, you know, basic liberties and rights. And, you know, you go back to parse everything that LeBron said yesterday. He didn't say a single word about the Hong Kong protesters, and neither did Adam Silver. All throughout last week, he never made any indication that he was going to stand up for the Hong Kong protesters or their rights, you know, directly or indirectly. And I think, you know, that's kind of the scary part of all this. Obviously, money's, you know, at stake in a big time way, but, you know, it's clear that the NBA wants nothing to do with a political battle that could get, you know, damaging to their bottom line.
Good stuff, Ben. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Take care. Ben Golliver of the Washington Post. The Minnesota Wild are in town to take on the Toronto Maple Leafs. We'll take a deeper dive into the Wild. Brian Lawton of the NHL Network joins Stephen Brunt and myself. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Afraid to put their name on it. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Right, the Astros and Yankees are just beginning their game three of their series on Sportsnet. First pitch is at 4.
And it's going to rain there tomorrow? Like it's going to rain here tomorrow?
Supposedly going to rain there tomorrow, which will create an interesting it's not really a dilemma. It's going to create an interesting pitching situation because that was supposed to be a bullpen day for
but
both.
Here's another question. I was thinking when we were talking to Jim Duquette about that. Can you remember a time in the postseason where both teams scheduled a bullpen day in the playoffs?
Wow.
No.
The only thing now, okay, I know, because the only thing I can remember is there, if you remember, there was a year where the Tampa Bay Rays and the Phillies were in the World Series and it snowed and it rained and there was a game that was, there were like 3 days without baseball. I don't think there was a bullpen game per se there, but I have the feeling.
Both teams, I think. Again,
No, it definitely wasn't both teams because the Phillies went with their regular rotation. So, no, it was definitely wasn't both
so
teams.
This was, so that's welcome to 2019.
Well, yeah, it is.
Like that's
bullpen
you know,
games.
It, and it's just like, oh, of course, it's a bullpen day in the postseason. Like,
well, and it was great.
Anybody having a bullpen day in a postseason.
Could you imagine that? Like when we were talking to Jim Duquette, he just made the point about it's a bullpen day for both teams. And we both kind of went,
oh, yeah,
okay, sure. Just like.
No, a bullpen day is what you do when, you know, you're there's. So something horrible happens to your pitching staff, right? Like
I remember talking to Jack Morris this year about bullpen. You can understand what Jack's reaction would be. And I said to him, what would your reaction have been if a manager had come up to you and said, hey, Jack, you know what? We're going to the bullpen day today. And, you know, his response was, well, if you go with the bullpen day today, I'll just leave and I'll go home and you know, hope that your bullpen works out. And he said, no, and by the way, I want to start in my regular turn. So he said, I'm not going to come back tomorrow and pitch. Anyhow.
Of course, Jack never talked about the games where he stayed out an inning or two too long, right?
Well, no.
I think he erased those ones. I'm not coming out. And then he got shelled.
Yeah. Anyhow, it'll be fascinating to see what happens. If it rains tomorrow and you've got bullpen games scheduled, I don't know what I would do.
I would think because it takes away the off day, that I would go to a starter because I'm not going to want to blow my bullpen out on and with no off day.
And I think the easiest answer too is let's see what happens tonight, right? I mean, if both teams have starters,
that's true enough, go deep.
Let's see what happens tonight. The Minnesota Wild are in town to take on the Toronto Maple Leafs tonight. That game will be on Sportsnet 590 The Fan at 7 o'clock. We just spoke to Luke Fox a little earlier in the show about the Minnesota Wild and just kind of where they are now and you know, as an older team that, quite frankly, has probably seen its window of opportunity go by. I remember thinking that this was a franchise that had it all going on at one point. A great arena, great fans, good ownership. I loved what they were doing. I loved how they were going for it. And I understood the division was tight and the conference was tight and all this. But, man, Luke Fox, when he dropped that average age on us, 29.5, I almost, you know,
yep.
My head almost hit the table here. Brian Lawton is an analyst with the NHL Network. Of course, he's no stranger to all things hockey in Minnesota. He joins Stephen Brunt and myself in Writer's Block. Brian, I want to start with the before we look around the NHL and talk about you know some of the surprising teams, the Avalanche and the Sabres in particular. Tell us what's happened to the Minnesota Wild.
Well. The Minnesota Wild were a little bit guilty of never really being good enough to compete for the cup, but never being bad enough to really bottom out. And that's gone on for a long time. They had made the playoffs 6 or 7 years before last season. And Chuck Fletcher, you know, he enhanced the group when he signed Parisi and Suter, but this is the 7th year of their 13-year contracts. So it certainly worked for the majority of it, but it never got them into that elite category. So what does that mean? It means, Jeff, do you buy into the philosophy? If you look at the teams that won all of the Stanley Cups, pretty much except for the St. Louis Blues, right? We're talking Penguins, mm-hmm. Kings, Blackhawks. They all employed a strategy which was very simple. And I know this because I also did this in Tampa. And it was be bad to be good. Okay, what does that mean? It means you're going to have some down years. You're going to accumulate some top five picks. And then you're going to build off of that. Crosby, Malkin. They had more guys. Fleury was in that mixture as well. They obviously rose up and won championships. Chicago Blackhawks, Kane, Taves. They rose up and won 3 championships also in the previous 10 seasons. LA Kings, to some degree, Kopitar and Doughty. And that worked really well until about 2010 when the Oilers came along and they were bad to be good 3 years in a row. And everybody said, that's enough of that. Mm-hmm. We got to change the lottery rules.
Yeah. They didn't get to the good part, by the way, Brian. I think they skipped right over that step, right? Yeah.
They skipped over that good part.
Yeah.
Now we're in this unprecedented times, though, where St. Louis wins and whoa. What do you mean they only have one player on their roster that was one of their top five picks, and now it's Pietrangelo? How did that happen? Why did that happen? And for me, it's very simple. The salary cap has pulled everybody closer together. And yeah. Those days of dynasties are going to be gone because now you really can't do that. In Tampa, we got Stamkos and Hedman. They haven't won a championship, but it's been a pretty good 10-year run. If you look at it nowadays, Colorado had the best pick, best opportunity last year. We changed the lottery in 2015, and it's very easy to not have a great season and end up picking fourth or fifth or sixth.
You know, it's
going to be tougher.
Yeah, I'm listening, Brian. I'm just thinking. You know, what is the? You're right. You know that the cycle has changed. The kind of franchise cycle has changed. But I'm trying to think what. You know, what's the optimal cycle now? Like, look, if you get a Sidney Crosby who plays forever and has the ability, you know, there's only one of him, but the ability to lift a team in a bunch of different ways all by himself and can kind of keep you competitive even when you're changing everybody around him. But, we've seen that doesn't work, you know, with a Connor McDavid even. And you're right that, you can't have a dynasty. If you look where max contracts are, you look at the bridge deals. I'm kind of wondering, it's not just bottom out for 3 years and then win for a couple of years and then tear it all down and then try it all over again. I think we're still figuring out what the cycle is, aren't we?
I'm not.
Okay.
But your question is valid.
Okay.
I mean, in my mind, it's very clear in my mind, and I'm being a little bit facetious, Stephen, but you know that.
That's okay. I can live with that. Educate me, man.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for me, I see it that, and we'll bring it back to the Minnesota Wild, everybody, I never really believed in, hey, just get in and anything can happen. I didn't really believe in that for, 10 of the last 11 years. Now I actually believe that. Go all in. If you have a team that you think can compete, go all in. And if you make the playoffs, your odds for success are, they're not great, but they're much better than they've ever been. So for me, to bring it back to the Minnesota Wild, I interviewed for that general manager position, and I can tell you quite frankly that everything about what I wanted to do was about being really, really aggressive. The team is 29.5 years average age. And I don't mean that's the average age of the roster. The roster is actually quite a bit younger than that. Mm-hmm. That's the average age of the players that are actually playing the minutes. That's the way we do it now.
Right.
Computers and analytics and all those wonderful things have allowed us to figure that out to the T, exactly what it is. And that's why the Wild, by my calculations before that job, were tied for the second oldest team in the league with the Pittsburgh Penguins. So, what does it mean for them? It means that their best chance for success was to be really, really aggressive and shake things up. They didn't do anything. They've had a slow start, and I think that brings us to where they are now. Now, to be fair to Billy Guerin, he's got to kind of learn the team, evaluate, then make his decisions. But I think that has to happen pretty quickly because the other piece we're not talking about, Jeff or Steven, is that most of the teams are not in a position to kind of go all in or take advantage of where we're at right today because they're so tight up against the salary cap.
Exactly, yeah.
The Minnesota Wild, that's right. The Minnesota Wild were actually unique in that they had a lot of salary cap space.
So that's where
the season.
So that's where they could be aggressive. That's what you're saying. Because I was wondering about what aggressive looks like in this cap system.
Yeah.
Obviously you can do things at the deadline and stuff, but what's aggressive look like?
Most of the teams cannot be aggressive. Aggressive looked like, and you talked about it all summer long, fellas, aggressive looked like a potential RFA offer. It looked like, you know, maybe some of the names that were just rumored. It doesn't mean they were available, but, you know, guys like Rasmus Ristolainen, you know, Kadri, that one was, we were talking about that months ago. You knew he was going to go at some point. So there was a lot of opportunity, actually, this summer. There's just not a lot of people to take advantage of it because they're not in a position to. So if your team isn't where you think it should be right now and you're not running to fix that in the next few years, you're going to miss the boat. Buffalo Sabres did a really nice job. I know you guys want to talk about that.
Yes.
They did a really nice job. A guy like Marcus Johansson, I cover the finals for NHL Network. He was terrific in the finals. All this guy can muster is a two-year deal at $4.5 million, which is what he was making. That was pure gold for teams. And he had to wait till the end of the summer. Your very own Jake Gardner, who's been kind of ridiculed there at times in Toronto, at $4 million for three seasons?
Mm-hmm.
If you're managing a team and you're not jumping out of your shoes to sign that guy, you're missing the boat. Carolina Hurricanes, I give him a lot of credit. Tom Dundon is making a lot of the decisions. He's a very big influence in there. He doesn't know anything about the past, but he does understand business. And I'm not surprised they're doing as well as they are. They've been aggressive. To think they bought a player from Toronto.
Yeah.
When would that happen 5 years ago for the Carolina Hurricanes?
Yeah, that's a great
Never.
Point. You know, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Sabres as well. I mean, they're 5-0-1, won their fourth consecutive home game. Victor Olofsson's got, what, seven power play goals? I mean, I think he's the first player in NHL history to do that. Ralph Kruger's kind of an interesting guy, isn't he? Because the story when he left Edmonton is that a year later, guys like Ryan Nugent Hopkins and Jordan Eberle, guys who'd been there, said, you know, we kind of think maybe we missed an opportunity with this guy. Now that we're looking back at it, some of the stuff he said seemed to make sense. It was almost as if absence made the heart grow fonder. He seems to be a perfect fit in Buffalo, doesn't he?
He really does. And a lot of people questioned Jason Botterell when he made that hire. What people forget is Jason, you know, Winnipeg native, also knew Ralph from Winnipeg and had a lot of confidence in him. And I knew he was excited to hire him. And he's been the perfect guy for them. You know, Jason went out, he talked to a lot of people this summer, like a Dave Tippett, who's having tremendous success in Edmonton. But at the end of the day, he found the right coach at the right time for his group. And he has found a way in the early parts here to really pull things together. To be fair to Phil Housley, they had a nice stretch last year, 10 mm-hmm. games essentially undefeated. But it just did not look like this. It didn't feel repeatable. They kind of beat the odds. They had an unusual string of luck, and eventually that faded, and it didn't work out for them. This year it feels different. Ralph's done a great job. He's very personable. He's a little bit old school in that way. He doesn't want you to know how much he knows as much as he wants you to know how much he cares. And so far it's been just really fun to watch the Sabres.
So you think that's, I guess, you think that's sustainable, Brian. Do you think Edmonton's sustainable? And again, I know they lost last night, but do you think what we saw, again, with the coaching change, you know, there was not a ton of optimism heading into the season, but the fact that they got out of the gate, does that feel sustainable to you?
I felt that, you know, the combination of Ken Holland and Dave Tippett is going to be a very powerful one. I felt that the combination of Dreisaitl and McDavid is a powerful one. I felt that Mike Smith would play better, as would Koskinen under Dave Tippett. I actually picked the Oilers to make the playoffs, and I got a lot of grief at NHL Network for it from some of my counterparts because they said, no way. They're a long way from making the playoffs, but I like what I've seen there. I do think that is sustainable. I just don't think it'll be at the level it's at right now. They're second in the league in PK, 95%. They're second in the league in power play, 40%. Those things are going to slow down. But the trade that they made to move Lucic out and move Neil in, to me, is a game changer. So far, we've seen that.
You saw Neil. So did you felt, because again, it felt like two teams dealing with each other's issues, each other's problems, but you thought Neil would thrive there.
I thought that Neil would have a chance to score 20 goals. I never thought he would be as good as he's been early, and it's only early, and he's a streaky player. But the fact of the matter is, Stephen, if you look at the contracts, if James Neal was the worst player in the National Hockey League and you were convinced that Lucic wasn't the right fit for him, it still was an excellent trade to make, because at least the contract allowed you more flexibility in terms of managing your cap. You can withstand mistakes if you can get out of them. There's a lot of contracts from the summer of 17 floating around out there that you just can't get out of. Milan Lucic's was one of them. James Neal was not. That was signed after. You know, you could look at Ladd, you could look at Oposo, you could look at Nielsen. We could pull up names from that infamous summer, and those should be on, if we have a do not draft list, those should be on the do not acquire list. not because they're not good players, guys, because you have no flexibility. And when you get trapped in this game and don't have flexibility, it is death because of how much the salary cap is moving now. It was okay when we started. More money every year in the system, cap increase, could bury mistakes. Now, you're completely exposed.
Yeah. Look, I never blame players for their contracts, right?
No, those guys are good guys. They're all good players. I'm friends with a lot of them. They got very, very favorable contracts that literally make them untradeable, but not in the way we used to talk about it as players.
Very quickly, before you let you run, I did want to ask you, Brian, any issue with what the Leafs have done with Rasmus Sandin?
No, none whatsoever. You know, the Leafs, every team has their own challenges. Their challenges are to find quality players on low money, and he fits that bill. But just because you need him doesn't mean he's ready for it. I think it's a very smart decision by them. I think he'll be better served for it long term. I think they'll be better served from it long term as well.
Great insight, Brian. We appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Anytime, guys.
Be well. That's Brian Lawton of the NHL Network. And again, Wild and Leafs tonight, 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. The Monday Nighter last night, more officiating controversy in the NFL. Talk about it. It's just like it's an ongoing story. More officiating controversy in the NFL. Jim Deopoulos is a former NFL official, former NFL supervisor of officials. He's one of our go-to guys whenever the NFL has a rules issue, which is generally every other day. Well, to be fair to them, every other week. This is Writer's Block with Blair and Brunn on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Every man for himself. The meditation.
All right, we're kind of used to the NFL having issues with plays like pass interference and, I guess, roughing the quarterback, hits to the head and all that. I mean, there are a lot of things that go on in an NFL game that sort of in the split second that demand, you know, that I think are good reasons for there to be video review. Last night in the Packers' 23-22 win over the Detroit Lions, there were a couple of calls that in and of themselves were odd. And the end result of the calls, both of them were illegal use of the hands.
Yeah, same guy, Trey Flowers.
Trey Flowers.
Both extended drives.
Both of them were illegal hands. The first penalty came against Packers offense. I think it was Bakhtiari. The drive was extended. Green Bay ended up getting a touchdown in the fourth quarter. The second flag against Flowers came in the drive that concluded with Mason Crosby's game-winning field goal. The NFL has since clarified that the second illegal use of hands penalty indeed was no foul. So in other words, a penalty that helped extend the drive that resulted in the game-winning field goal after review by the NFL was not a foul. You can't go and replay the game, Stephen.
No.
But it's odd that it's this penalty, though, isn't it?
Well, it's because in theory, it's pretty clear. It should be a pretty clear-cut penalty. There are a lot of reasons why the Lions lost that game last night. In some reasons, ways it was them being the Lions. You know, they had opportunities to score the two, you know, where they ended up trading field goals for touchdowns. They should have won the game. But those two calls especially, you know, again, extending scoring drives, that on replay, if you're watching it, you just said that's not hand to the face. That is not an illegal, you know, that's not a penalty. Both of them didn't. Neither of them look like penalties. Extended drives, both scoring drives, decisive in the game. Yeah, confused a lot of people watching that game last night.
Jim Deopoulos is a former NFL official and supervisor, and we're very pleased that he joins us on Writer's Block. Jim, thanks so much for joining Stephen Brunt and myself today. I think you probably heard from our conversation, it seems to me to be really odd to have this type of penalty. And again, I understand it's less the penalty than it is the result of what happened after the penalty. But have you seen a situation where we've dealt with such a specific penalty, illegal hands, and on the same player, you know? And again, it's not like this guy's from what we're led to believe, it's not like he's a repeat offender or anything like that. How did you view that?
Well, first of all, guys, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, you see that again, these types of calls, these types of rules are in there to protect the player. You know, what you don't want the way, offense or defense, you don't want it to put the heel of the hand up under the chin or on the face mask and pushing the head straight back. It's just, it's not a good scene. It's not a good issue for the player. So they try to protect the players. It was very unusual to see this called in this type of a situation this many times, and it just did not appear to me that it needed to be called. You know, sometimes as an official, you're watching, you're trying to protect it, but sometimes you just miss it. And unfortunately, the umpire just missed it on this one. He was a little bit too focused on where the head was going back. And some of those guys, they're pretty good guys. I'll tell you, they put their head back, and it gives the perception that his head is being, you know, jammed back. So, you know, it was a tough situation, a tough call. And why is it always at a point where it has such an effect on the game? It just seems that we're always in this type of situation, you know, whether it's this play or, you know, a pass interference, always something that causes all this controversy.
Hey, Jim, I'm wondering, you know, I understand the NBA does this. I don't know if the NFL does, but could this be a point of emphasis thing at all? Does the NFL have that where it will talk to officials before a game and say, look, you know, we know that this one team is prone to, I don't know, to, you know, a certain type of play, or this team is prone to try something like this that's illegal along the line of scrimmage. Could that be a factor here at all?
Well, I can tell you, in all the years that I was involved with the league, that is not something the league does.
Okay.
You don't want the officials going in there with any kind of a preconceived idea of, hey, we're going to watch this player or this team. You know, teams will tell, coaches will tell you before the game, this is what we're going to run. Just be aware of this. They don't want us to get caught off guard. But you don't go in there looking for things. Enough stuff happens during the game that you really don't need to be looking, you know, for situations and looking for fouls to occur.
Jim, where, you know, again, this anytime this kind of thing happens where it's decisive in a game, and it certainly, you know, those both of those calls had a huge influence on that game last night. People start talking about reviewable calls. You know, we've got, this is the first year with pass interference as a reviewable call. What it feels like, replay officials are loath to overturn what happens on the field. Wherever the bar is set, they're not overturning anything that's marginal there. And maybe not even turning over some things that look pretty obvious on replay. Do you think, though, Jim, like the trend is going to be to more reviewable calls? And what does that do to the guys on the field calling the game? I wonder a little bit this year even whether it's, you know, makes guys a little less decisive, you know, a little more willing to fall back on the technology, and whether it affects how officials call a game on the field if they know there's an eye in the sky.
Great question. And, you know, I was involved in when I first got in the league, there was no replay, and then it came into the league. And I've always been an advocate of instant replay, to review reviewable plays, to review questionable calls. It's a great officiating tool. I think what they're doing is they're expanding it much too much right now. They're looking at too many things that make it very difficult, for the individuals on the field. It's such a tough game to officiate, and you've got to understand there are so many young officials working out there right now. There's been a tremendous number of turnovers in the league over the past few years. You have, for instance, this past year, you have 7 new referees. That's unprecedented, and you got to understand that this game is just such that it all comes down to basically experience. You've got to be able to see these plays, look at them over and over again, and there's just an awful lot of inexperienced officials out there, which is having an effect on the calls that are going on.
What do you think in terms of watching the pass interference reviews this year, Jim? Like obviously, this all stems from that the play in the Rams Saints game. Essentially decided which team was going to go to the Super Bowl. The league couldn't allow that to happen again. They had to do something. But when you actually see how that system has worked with pass interference this year, what are from your point of view, is it working? Is it a Pandora's box? You know, there are a lot of people, because people thought, you're going to start fishing for calls in these situations. But again, what I'm seeing is that they seem very, very reluctant to overturn whatever's called on the field.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. And one of the things that you need to be aware of is those decisions are not being made by replay. Those decisions are being made by Al Riveron, who's the vice president of officiating. So he is making all the decisions. All the replay officials do in the booth at the game is they'll stop the game and they'll send the information to New York. But Al Riveron makes those decisions. It used to be that the referee would make it with the help of the replay official, but those calls are being made by New York. Now, Al has his guidelines. I mean, he sat through the owners' meetings, the competition committee meetings, so he knows what they want. It's amazing the number of the few replays that have been reversed this year. I mean, we've watched the games. I see plays that I think need to be reversed. But, again, it's Al's call. It's Al, it's Al's decision to be made. And so many of these, it's just judgment. And if he doesn't think there is a clear and obvious infraction that he can see on film, then he's going to just let that play stand.
I think there's only been, if I'm not mistaken, 4 of 38 team challenges have been reversed after review. That's not many.
That's probably more than I thought were actually reviewed. I mean, and changed. Yeah, he's sticking with the stands and he's going with the officials on the field. But again, at some point, we got to get this right, or basically, just go back to the 80s and before when there was no replay.
Yeah,
just let him play football. Our problem is we expect this game to be perfect. We expect the officials to be perfect, and they're not. They're not perfect in hockey, they're not perfect in baseball, nor are they perfect in basketball. But we expect the NFL officials to be perfect, and they make mistakes. They're pretty good. They do a really good job, but they do make mistakes. And that's just part of the game. Players make mistakes, and coaches make mistakes. But for some reason, we as fans just can't fathom the idea of NFL officials making a mistake.
Yeah, and I it is an incredibly hard job. Like I acknowledge that right off the top. But the thing I don't understand is if you're going to bring in a replay review for pass interference specifically, again, based on that play that happened in the NFC Championship game, I'm not sure what the point is if the only thing that you would reverse potentially would be something as absolutely clear cut and as that play in the NFC Championship game. But once you review it, you got to review it, don't you? Like the bar has got to be where it would be when you watch it, when you're calling a game on the field.
We're not certain where the bar has been set is the problem right now. You look at that play in the Saints Rams game, and had there not been that helmet contact, then we wouldn't even be talking about this. We just talk about it as a bang bang play. I mean, I don't know if you saw the play last night. The Detroit player was interfered with late in the game. There was a hand across the chest.
Mm-hmm.
Obvious, clear and obvious to me. But they didn't challenge it. It wasn't brought up as a challenge because I think the coaches have become very skeptical about throwing the flag.
They're gun shy. Yep.
It cost them a time. You know, I don't know. Do you start reviewing everything? But now we're getting to a point where, it still comes down to judgment. Let me tell you, the NFL guys are really good on rules. They're not going to miss rule interpretations. They are excellent on rules. Are they going to miss judgments? We're all going to miss judgments. We can all think of it one way, and then the league will think of it another. It all comes down to a judgment call. The problem is we have so many different camera angles that sometimes they don't get them up in New York to make a decision. We get some better shots on TV. The guys out on the field are just making gut calls, split-second calls, trying to make these decisions.
Hey, Jim, I want to go off the beaten path for a little minute here. We had an incident in Sunday's American League Championship Series game where the home plate umpire, Corey Glazer, missed a call. He thought it was a foul tip. Gary Sanchez did a very good job of selling it to him. The replay showed that it was nowhere near being a foul tip. The replay was shown on the scoreboard in the stadium. I'm sure Corey Glazer saw it. But it's not reviewable under baseball's rules. Of course, the very next pitch, which was a ball a couple of innings earlier, was called a strike. Gary Sanchez was upset. We all said, aha, the dreaded makeup call. And Jim, I got to tell you, I don't have, and maybe this puts me in the minority, I don't have a problem with the makeup call in an important game. Am I way off base here?
You know, as an official or being involved in officiating, yeah, you're way off base.
Okay.
Subconsciously, it might happen out there. And I'll tell you, one of my bucket lists would be to stand behind the plate and call balls and strikes in a Major League Baseball game to see that ball coming in and doing all different things. I don't even see how they can, make a decision. Do they miss some? Absolutely they do. But, man, those guys are right on. But, in football, if I was out there making a call and I made a call and, God, it is a pass interference, I call pass interference. And then the play's going on and I look up on the big board and I see, God, I missed that big time. Now, all of a sudden, I come back. Well, I'm going to try to even this thing up. Next thing I do, I mess up another one. Now I got two mistakes. And the next thing you know, I'm going to be looking for a new job. So, it doesn't really work like that. It seems that way a lot, but I cannot. I'll tell you, that pitch to Sanchez was, what, maybe 2 or 3 inches outside?
Yes.
But when it's going 100 miles an hour with movement, I'm trying to figure out how he even sees that ball. In answer to your question, I don't think they do anything makeup-wise.
But do you guys look up at the scoreboard, though, and watch that replay and go, maybe I missed that one?
I guess I shouldn't have said that.
I believe you just did.
I was notorious. There would be a loose football out there when I was on the field, and everybody would be getting together, and I'd kind of tilt my hat a little bit and peek up at the ball, and I'd go, "Hey, that's Giants ball, guy. Let's just go. It's Giants ball." And no, but the officials are not supposed to be looking up there, and they're not supposed to be. If it's that questionable, it's not supposed to be up on the board like that. But you sneak a peek every now and then to see, hey, was I right or was I wrong? And I can tell you, these guys, the guys in the NFL, are most critical of themselves. I mean, they live and die with every call. As soon as the game's over, they are getting in the bus to head to the airport, and they've got their DVDs with the game already on it, and they're plugging them up there to look at every call that they made. And when they know when they miss them. Sometimes we don't realize they miss them, but they know when they miss them, and they're very critical of themselves.
Hey, Jim, great insight as always. Thanks so much.
Anytime, guys. I'd be glad to talk to you anytime. Have a great day.
All right, you too. That's Jim Deopoulos, former NFL official and official supervisor, and just a great guy to have on when you're talking about this. See, I like the idea of the makeup call.
Mm, it's a little tougher in football.
Well, understandably. Yeah. Understandably. But I have no problem. Hockey, I've never had a problem with a makeup call. Basketball, I want it transparently makeup-able. Then I'm okay. Then I feel okay. It's fine. Justice has kind of been served.
Yes.
Now, admittedly, I'm not a gambler. So if I was a gambler,
you might feel differently.
I might feel differently. Yeah. But I loved that. I loved that Sunday night. I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. I think it was absolutely the right thing to do for Corey Glaser.
Yeah, well, that one actually leveled the playing field. Sometimes it's a bit of a slippery slope.
What happened in that inning, by the way? We're watching it in the MLB Network. It was 1-0. I looked up
the bases, and then somebody grounded out, and they nothing across. They had Gerrit Cole a little bit on the ropes, and nothing came across.
Yeah, I did see that there was a fly ball to center field, and George Springer was, shall we say, approached it rather delicately. The shadows at Yankee Stadium, by the way. I know we hardly ever talk about shadows anymore because they don't get these starts. But, man, oh, man, I've covered games that are shadows at Yankee Stadium in the afternoon. Oh, Derek Jeter used to talk about how he used to hate that. How he used to, more than anything else, he used to hate playing in shadows. He said that when he was with the Yankees, I mean, I remember asking him one time. I said, when you're out on the field and you're in, it's the playoffs, it's postseason, what do you see when you're out there? Mm. And he said, it's kind of like being in a Broadway show. There's just lights, and I don't see any of the faces anywhere around me. I'm aware of my teammates, blah, blah, blah. And then I remember him saying, but when we're playing day baseball and there's shadows, he said, I'm always, always, always following the ball. Because he said, if you don't, you'll lose that perception. You lose that perception of it. A reminder, by the way, that you could win one of $5,500 prize packs and qualify for a grand prize sports weekend getaway, including tickets to see both Toronto teams back-to-back with the VTech wake-up call. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. Find out how to win at sportsnet.ca/590. Mr. Brunt and myself will come back and put a bow on it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
You can win a $1,000 prize courtesy of DeWalt. Listen weekday mornings for the cue to text. Tell us who you think is built to win. Text 590-590 with your vote. The keyword win to enter. Full contest details at sportsnet.ca/590. Tim and Sid just a few seconds away on Sportsnet 590. Fan on the network. 2-0 for the Houston Astros. Josh Reddick just taking one into the second deck at Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. Steve Brunt. That game on the other Sportsnet stations. Jose Altuve hit a first inning home run. Gerrit Cole loaded the bases, got out of it. But man, oh man, the long balls are certainly gonna coming out here.
It's funny that, you know, like I've assumed that the winner of assumed that this series would happen from about, you know, what, July 1st on, maybe, or yeah, August 1st on, and assumed that the winner of this series would win the World Series.
Yep.
Right. I'm wobbling on that right now, and just. Look, I still think that either of these teams, the Yankees aren't, there's a bunch of guys not hitting for the Yankees right now. But I think that if you put Washington, assuming they're going to win that series, up against one of these teams, that eventually you get into the soft core of the Washington bullpen, and that's decisive. That you know, Strasburg's not going to do what he did last night, and Scherzer's not going to do, and Anibal Sanchez isn't going to throw a one hitter. And eventually you're going to get into the soft middle of that bullpen, and that's what will, but I'm less convinced of that right now than I would have been. Well, I don't know, a week ago?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things happening. One, you know, as long as Victor Robles stays healthy, we underestimate how deep that Nationals lineup is.
Yep.
Like Anthony Rendon is one of the best hitters in baseball. He's going to make so much money this offseason. Trey Turner, Juan Soto, and I know I took a little bit of grief for saying this a couple of weeks ago, but Juan Soto and Ronald Acuna, those guys have raised the bar for what it means to be a young, impactful player in this game.
Yeah, and Soto's struggling a bit right now at the plate, and he had that kind of spectacular tumble last night. But, you know, we still got a ways to go in this postseason. They can do things with that offensively. Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, that everybody knows what their Achilles heel is, and it's about five guys in the bullpen.
Well, right? What'll be interesting, let's see what Patrick Corbin brings, because I think if Patrick Corbin has a good start, and if they do win this, We talked about the importance of rest. If they do win this, they can set up their pitching however they want going into the World Series. But if Patrick Corbin pitches well, now I think you've got that starter's arm that you can bring out of the bullpen. That's kind of my one concern with the Nationals. It's nice that Steven Strasburg volunteered to come out of the bullpen if necessary. I would rather not have to use Scherzer or Strasburg as my starter out of the bullpen. I'd rather have it be one of the other two guys.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
And
you know, given the way Sanchez pitched that first game, we might not, you know, like that's the one. Yeah, like that may be in a bit of a mirage, but.
And I think
we'll see what Corbin does.
Right, but I think if Corbin's on, his stuff plays better, I think, out of the pen as that guy, just to give you an inning or whatever. And again, a lot will depend on the matchups. Frankly, and I hadn't thought of this, but somebody pointed out if it's New York and Washington, you know, weather's going to be a concern. I mean, we kind of, especially at this time of year, if weather's a concern, that could also throw, a kink into things as well.
They'll play through almost anything, but you would think on the East Coast heading into late October, you're going to lose a game in there somewhere. Right?
Yeah.
Probably.
I am with you. I'm the Astros or Yankees will be the favorite going in, but if someone wants to make a case to me that Washington's somehow capable of winning in seven or something like that, I wouldn't shut them up completely.
Well, their pitching staff, their starting pitching staff head to head with Houston's is a very interesting argument, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of classic stuff. Their pitching staff head to head with the Yankees, they've got a better starting pitching staff than the Yankees. They don't have that, the Yankees have the crazy bullpen. But again, this Yankees lineup, if it's scuffling a little bit, Gary Sanchez not hitting at all. Edwin looks, we've seen what Edwin looks like when he's cold.
You made
cold.
The point yesterday. Yes.
This is cold Edwin.
Right?
Giancarlo
Stanton may be available for pinch hitting. Now, granted, he hasn't been around all year.
So it's not quite murderer's row right now the way it has been. And, I still odds-on favorite. Whoever wins this game today, wins this series, is the odds-on favorite to win the World Series. And that would have been the case, I say, on the 15th of August. We would have said the same thing. But those other guys have crept into the conversation, and it's, the way they have won in the postseason. I know they were one of the best teams by record in the last half of the season, but it's the way they've won in the postseason that's convinced me.
Well, and to me, it's also kind of just reinforced how, unless you are a really, really, really elite team, there is something to be said for a team that has to, go to the whip hand early in the year and is life and death to make the playoffs.
Yeah,
in the
see them versus
card.
The Dodgers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's something to be said for being that team. That to me, that's why I think the wild card's a thing of beauty, and why I wouldn't mind having another wild card game added to the equation.
Yep, me too.
Because it does create that sense of dynamism, and you do have dynamic teams coming out of the wild card. Nobody backs in out of the wild card.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Nobody
I'm
backs
absolutely
in out of the wild
you.
Card. That's it for Writer's Block today. Tim and Sitter next. Don't forget, Wild Leaf, 7 o'clock, Sportsnet, 590 The Fan. Astros, Yankees, they are on right now in Sportsnet. Cards, Nats, Flyers and Flames tonight as well in Sportsnet 360. Have a great day, everybody.